your record.
I know, I'm a perfect record. He's not shot. Actually, this is the second time.
I'd like to call the 14th meeting of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. And I note for the record that there is a quorum present of Representative T. Davis and Representative Penny Jones. And absent from the committee are Representative Foster and excused is Representative Cato. And on the agenda before us are House Bill 193, House Bill 253, House Bill 259, House Bill 266, and Committee Substitute Senate Bill 173, Community and Regional Affairs. And the first bill that we'll hear is Committee Substitute Senate Bill 173, Community and Regional Affairs. The Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 173 is Community and Regional Affairs. We clarify procedures relating to municipal petitions and elections which were missed when Title 29 was revised. This is one of the Alaska Municipal League's legislative priorities and has the support of the Alaska Association of Municipal Clerks. There is a zero fiscal note from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and we will be on teleconference for this bill. And here to speak on behalf of the legislature is Martha Stewart.
Good afternoon. We are on teleconference.
We are on teleconference. Welcome, Dave Vaughn.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Martha Stewart. I'm an aide to Senator Al Adams. Senator Adams introduced this legislation at the request of the Alaska Municipal League. I could run through all the sections of the bill. In your packets has been an explanation of what was done in the CNRA committee and what the original bill consisted of. There are no hidden agendas in the bill or hidden parts to it. It's just a housekeeping measure, and to go at length of what's contained in the bill would probably be boring. So in the CNRA committee, we added three sections to the bill. One of those sections is Section 7 on voter qualifications, requiring that a voter in a municipal election be registered at a residence and the address within a municipality at least 30 days before the election. We also added Section 9 having to do with when a voter's name is purged. There was a question on the Senate floor about what the policies are with purging voters' names. If someone hasn't voted in two elections, their name is, they are sent notice that their name is going to be removed from the state election rolls. And then if they do not wish to have that happen, they can send the card back in. So people are notified before their name is removed. But this would require that they must re-register in order to vote in the municipal election. And then the last section of the bill, Section 21, has to do with making the definition of voter conform to what was added in Section 7. If you have specific questions about the bill that are suited to answer those, it'd probably be Scott Burgess or Linda Edgeworth, who's here from the Division of Elections.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Martha. We'll hear from Gay Vaughn. Gay?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Representative McLean, for the opportunity to testify. I'm Gay Vaughn. I'm chairman of the Alaska Municipal League Subcommittee on Education, Local Government Powers, and Elections. I'm a municipal clerk for over 12 years in the state of Alaska, and I currently serve as chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Association of Municipal Clerks. This bill has come about at our request to help clean up some of the oversights or errors, whatever, that were in the rewrite of Title 29. It brings into conformity some of the petition process for initiatives, referendums, in that current Title 29 allows for adoption or deletion of a manager plan or local option or unification procedures to be done by petition, but it doesn't specify the petition process. This clarifies that the process will be those used by initiatives and referendums as outlined in Title 29. It also tightens up the qualifications for municipal voters in local elections. There has been some problem in areas of the state dealing with that issue, in that Title 29 is kind of loose or kind of general and doesn't specify that you have to live in that municipality. It also indicates that there will be one prime sponsor that the clerk must deal with when doing initiative referendums and recalls, so that clerks are not in the situation where they're dealing with 400 or many, many sponsors of those petitions. One thing that was added in the Senate was Section 9, as Martha pointed out. It does allow for municipalities to not count those people who have been purged after 2 years unless they do so by local option, by ordinance. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions? Thank you, Ms. Vaughn. And we also have Scott Burgess to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Scott Burgess with the Alaska Municipal League. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. I think you've gotten a good presentation from Martha Stewart and Gabe Vaughn.
Are there any questions? Thank you. That Representative Foster has joined us. Okay, we have Committee Substitute Senate Bill 173, Community and Regional Affairs, an act relating to municipal petitions and elections and to appointments to fill certain municipal offices for your consideration.
Madam Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill number 173 with individual recommendations.
Okay, there is a motion on the floor. Are there any objections? Hearing none, motion carried. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Vaughn. Okay, the next. Agenda is House Bill 193, an act relating to vacancies on and reallocation of elected board seats in areas of the unorganized world. House Bill 193 was introduced by the governor. This legislation would declare vacant REAA school board seats where no candidate filed for an election. In such a case, the remaining school board members would elect a candidate to fill the empty seat. This procedure would also be enacted in regards to Coastal Resource Service Area Board. Another aspect of the bill would allow the Lieutenant Governor to reallocate seats when the census statistics upon which they are based are more than 5 years old and where other more reliable census data exist. There are zero fiscal notes from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs and the Division of Elections in your file, along with the Governor's transmittal letter. Here to speak on behalf of the legislation is Linda Edgeworth from the Division of Elections.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Linda Edgeworth, Information Officer for the Division of Elections. This bill was the culmination of work done by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, the Department of Education, as well as the governmental coordination from the Office of Management and Budget. And it is primarily proposed to resolve three major problems that continually exist in school boards and rural coastal resource service areas that cause a creative burden, cause a lot of confusion for voters, and also for the officials who are serving in the seats on these rural boards. The first one is that right now, under the provisions in law for the membership on school, on rural school boards and coastal resource service areas, there is no set time frame at which a new elected official takes office. Mm-hmm. This bill serves to resolve that. We've had one school district that had a controversy in their school board, and so the duly elected official from the October 1988 election wasn't seated until February, and there was nothing in statute to resolve that question as to when a new official takes office. This bill allows the discretion to remain in the hands of the local boards because it only stipulates that the newly elected office official takes office at the first regular meeting held after certification of the election. So the school district or the Coastal Resource Service Area still has some discretion with regard to when they conduct that first meeting, but it does stipulate a time certain as to when the new official will take office. Another existing problem, primarily in school districts, is that we have several areas of the state where there are continuous fluctuations in population. An example would be in southeastern communities like REAA 19, where logging camps fluctuate from one area to another and populations shift from one area to another. Well, right now, under current law, there is no way for a school district or the Commissioner of Education to respond to those population fluctuations for the purpose of allocating seats to represent voters and citizens and students in a specific school board. As a result, what happens is we end up with school districts that are divided into sections, having one section that is overrepresented while another section becomes underrepresented. And so this would allow the Commissioner of Education in concurrence with the school district to actually determine that if the census data is more than 5 years old and there is other population data that would support a shifting of seats, that they would be able to accommodate that, and after their survey of the population data has been resolved and solidified, then at the next school board election, they could shift a seat at a time when a seat would normally be up for election and move it to an underrepresented section. So we have had about 3 or 4 school districts that have come to us with this dilemma over the last couple of years, and so the bill attempts to address that problem. The final problem that hopefully will be resolved by this bill is that occasionally, it becomes rarer and rarer, but it is a major problem that causes a lot of confusion for voters, certainly the officials in the area, and causes a tremendous burden on election boards and the Division of Elections, is that every once in a while, a school district or a coastal service area has no one file for a particular seat. The incumbent does not seek re-election, and no one else files for office either. As a result, we end up in a specific REA, for example, where there are 3 or 4 sections. Most school boards are nominated by section but elected at large, but the voter gets a blank ballot. There is no one on the ballot, and yet the ballot will instruct them that they can cast one vote, and the vote has to be for someone who lives in a different section or resides in an area for which the majority of this section has no idea who to write in there. And so it causes a lot of confusion. I can give you an example of what it does to precincts and what it does to this. I won't open this up in full, but these are write-in candidates for one seat on a board. This is 3 or 4 times longer here. As a result, out of 1,257 ballots cast, the winner of an election may get 4 or 5 votes. They happen to be the winner. We've had circumstances, and thank heaven it doesn't happen very long, but the hours of manpower and trying to audit this kind of an election is almost impossible. And what happens is we had over 120 different write-in names in this particular election. And what happens quite frequently is that we have 2 or 3 people who tie with 2 or 3 write-in votes. And what happens then is that we have to then call all these people and ask if they're willing to serve. And most of them said, what? I've been elected to what? What does that mean? What do I have to do? I didn't know anything about it. And I can remember I think it was around 1987, the election in 87, one of the districts, and I'm sorry, I can't remember which one, we had 3 people tie with 3 write-in votes each. And none of them, it turned out, were willing to serve. So we had the first 2 were eliminated because they declined serving at all. The 3rd person didn't want to serve either, but the only mechanism available to us under the existing statutes was to ask that person if they would at least be sworn into office and then formally resign. Now what happens when they resign is that the statute already provides that when a vacancy is created, the vacancy can be filled by appointment by the balance of the board. And at least then they have some option to recruit, to review potential candidates, and get together and find someone who is willing to serve and or has expressed an interest, and the board can make that determination. So the way this bill structures it is that if no one has filed for office, the seat does not go on the ballot, but rather after certification of the election, at the initial and first regular election scheduled after certification, that seat becomes officially vacant, and the vacancy filling vacancy by appointment statute would come into play. And so those are the three issues that are hopefully resolved by this election or this proposal. One of the things that I should point out is that I know that all Coastal Resource Service Area boards received a copy of this bill. I know that all the superintendents of rural school boards received a copy of this bill through the Superintendents Association. And we have not received any negative comments about it. I spoke personally with five superintendents from Chatham School District, the Whittier area, Bethel, and the Lower Kuskokwim School District, and I think two or three entities have actually written letters of support that are in your packets. In addition, when we suggested that we were going to try to work with the other departments to prepare such a bill, the state review board that audits the elections statewide were very enthusiastic in their support, and I believe there's a letter from the members of the state review board supporting this legislation.
Are there any questions?
What this bill would do then would be to preclude any write-in votes, regardless of how many votes they got at all, right?
That is virtually the case. One of the difficulties is that first of all, the petition process is very simple in rural school boards. As a matter of fact, we would endorse even making it even simpler by not even requiring a petition, but allowing a declaration of candidacy, even though it's a nonpartisan election. But the signature requirements are 10 voters. But most of the time, there is no record of any kind of official write-in, and most of the time, with very few exceptions, the write-ins are strictly people putting in. And we found one of the issues that comes up very frequently is because the ballot says the candidate must reside in and then list the number of communities for that section for which the seat is up for election, they write in a community name. We did give consideration to the fact that it is basically eliminating write-in candidacies on these school boards. And that's why we sought to see how school districts would respond, and we talked to the Attorney General's office to determine, if there might be a problem. But our perspective on it is that the filing process is pretty simple, and even the incumbent has chosen not to run, and there is nothing in law about organization of write-in campaigns or being aware that write-in campaigns are being waged. And so the confusion to the voter to get a blank ballot and be told to elect somebody, we get lots of calls from election workers who are trying to explain to people, yes, you're right, this is a blank ballot, you have to nominate somebody or write in somebody, but that person can't live in your own area, it has to live in this section over here. And so we tried to weigh the pros and cons and the benefits and the pitfalls, and we recognize that we are eliminating the write-in campaign, and that might somewhere along the line disenfranchise a candidate who wants to run a write-in campaign, we think that the benefits outweigh that hazard.
Yeah, you think it would be unconstitutional not to allow somebody to win an election by a write-in. Like you say, you're disenfranchising a certain segment of the population. See, 3 or 4 years ago, we had a city council election in Nome, and the guy that won a seat and got the largest number of votes, more than anybody that was listed on the ballot, was a write-in. And what you're saying is, from henceforth, forever, is that if there's a vacancy, if there's nobody files for a certain board seat, what you're saying is that you will not accept any write-ins. Because a lot of people will think, hey, there's nobody filed for that thing, I'm going to run for that. And apparently nobody has done that so far, but in the future somebody might say, hey, I'd like that seat if nobody's going to take it, I'm going to run as a write-in, but you won't accept it.
Madam Chairman, we recognize that that is the downside of this. We feel that the superintendents that we've talked to in the areas that we've talked to have all been pretty supportive that the trade-off in confusion on the part of voters, the rarity of official write-in campaigns, and the chaos in the process of administering the election, we recognize the issue that you're raising, we're very concerned that it has been an existing problem that doesn't seem to have any other solution that might be viable. So we recognize that is an issue.
I mean, is it constitutional to say, hey, we're not going to take that in?
Well, we certainly have that in our primary elections in the state. There are no write-ins allowed in...
In the primary.
Yeah, and I think there are lots of elections where there are no write-ins, and I don't think there's anything unconstitutional about that. As long as the opportunity to file for office is made, and you know, people have the option of doing that.
Okay, are there any further questions? Representative Petty Jones.
On page 1, line 29 of the bill, there's just, and I'm not, if you're not the person for to ask this question, let me know and I'll see if I can ask somebody else. You're talking about population data, which establishes that board members do not represent equal numbers of people. Shouldn't there be a qualifier on that? We aren't requiring absolute equality. We're just requiring approximate equality. I mean, so I think that could be read, you know, if there's a 2% deviation, it's not equal. And I don't think you ought to be reapportioning under those circumstances.
Madam Chairman, I think that that is qualified by the addition and the reference to a section under D of the section, which is on line 2 of page 2. And I think that is the existing statute that talks about as near as practicable an equal number of people. The three or four school districts that have come to us with these kinds of dilemmas, the population variances have been greatly.
I understand. Let me get that statute up.
While you're waiting for the statute, I have a question on the coastal area boards. What is their reaction to this issue?
I talked to Jan Caulfield, who is from governmental coordination, works with these boards. And when I talked to her last week prior to the earlier hearing that was scheduled, she indicated that she had not had any negative comments come back to her. However, she, late last week, I understand, was going to some meetings with some of these people, and that she was going to advise me if she received any questions. And I have not heard from her that there have been any other issues raised by those board members.
Mm-hmm. Representative Petty Jones.
No, I don't think it's in this subsection D. It just talks about multi-member sections and how each seat is designated by a letter or a number, and have to indicate which seat the candidate is seeking for. Section, there's nothing in there about approximate equality.
Is it subsection A under 1408051A?
Oh, A. I was looking at D. I think.
Well, I think I said D, but I think there are two references here, and I don't have the full statute in front of me, but it might be A that talks about socioeconomic and contiguous geographic area and those other kinds of qualifiers. But I'm not sure which subsection it is. That is correct. It would adopt the same procedures for both. They both are handled in the same manner, and all the statutes tend to conform the election procedures from one for the other. They're handled in the same manner. So these are conforming to continue the process through.
Madam Chairman, I think that the language needs to be amended on line 29 because it doesn't, you're right, section A does have a reference to as nearly as practicable an equal number of persons, but there's no reference to section A in that, in this new language. It just says equal, flat out. If the census is 5 years old, the population data shows that they don't represent equal number of people, then they're apportioned. So I would suggest an amendment, which I'll offer at a later time.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Ms. Edgeworth? Hearing none, we have House Bill 193 for your consideration.
I do have an amendment to offer this bill, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
Page 1, line 29, after the word represent, approximately, and the same word on page 2, line 3, after the word equal, or after the word achieve. Put in the word approximately.
After the word?
Achieve on page 2, line 3. Because the way, the purpose of the amendment is the current language talks about flat out total, you know, equality. If there's a variation of 1 or 2%, it's not equal. And under those circumstances, I don't think we ought to be out there reapportioning things. There ought to be some major discrepancies before they go off and go through that exercise.
Okay. So you're offering that as an amendment on line 3, page 2.
Well, it's in two places, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
That's the language that's in the other.
Is approximately or?
No, I didn't offer that.
Instead of using approximately as nearly as practicable, which is repeats the language.
Yeah, could I amend that? Amend the amendment, Madam Chairman. Okay.
You're still talking.
I'm still chatting. Huh? Okay. Well, then I am ready to make a formal motion. And the motion is the bill to be amended in two places. First place, page 1, line 29, after the word represent, insert a comma, and the words as nearly as practicable, comma.
Okay.
And then on page 2, line 3, after the word achieve, insert the same language, a comma followed by as nearly as practicable.
And. There's an amendment motion on the floor. Page 1, line 29. After represent, comma, as nearly as practicable, comma.
Right.
And then on page 2, line 3, after the word achieve, the same word, comma, as nearly as practicable, comma.
Correct.
Okay. Do I hear any objections on the amending motion? Hearing none, motion carried. Okay, we have before you House Bill 193 as amended for your consideration.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Now. In the past, since I'm the only person here that's not a freshman, what might be done here is to have a committee substitute proposed, and so it would be a proposed committee substitute which we would need to adopt and then move out. But depending on how the chair wants to handle it, you can either wait for that committee substitute to be actually drafted and be before the committee, which normally isn't really necessary when there's only been a minor change such as this.
Okay.
So
we have the proposed committee substitute, House Bill 193, for your consideration. Okay, there's a motion on the floor to move it out of committee with individual recommendations. Any objections? Hearing none, motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we have House Bill 266. which would allow a municipality to place a lien against real property in order to, oh, we're on teleconference. House Bill 266 would allow a municipality to place a lien against real property in order to secure payment for services provided by a utility owned by the municipality. There is no fiscal impact to this legislation, and we are on teleconference for this. Here to speak on its behalf is Dave Stancliffe, Legislative Aide to Representative Dick Schultz. I'd like to welcome Susan Knowles, who's on teleconference. Susan, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Representative
McGrane.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Dave?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Dave Stancliffe. I'm Legislative Assistant to Representative Schultz. And this piece of legislation has also been introduced on the Senate side. I understand that it is in Senate rules now. It's been introduced by Senator Adams. Representative Schultz introduced it by request from those folks who he represents in Nenana, who have occasionally come up against a problem with trying to determine whether or not they can put a lien against real property for outstanding charges for water and sewer services. And probably the letter from the city of Nenana, which I guess is in the package, best explains their frustrations, and they would like this, this statutory addition to give clarification so that the state Supreme Court I guess would have some criteria to go on should this be challenged. And at that I guess I'd entertain any questions that I could answer. I'm probably not the best person technically to be talking about this part of the statute, but it seems fairly simple at this point.
Are there any questions for Mr. Stancliffe?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We're giving the municipally owned utilities a means of recovering which other utilities do not have. Would that be correct?
That's correct.
Why?
Probably because the other two utilities have not asked for it.
I wonder if we might ask them, or if they're even aware of this bill. I think it's probably a problem for some small, not the big boys, but the smaller utilities who provide electrical service or water service or whatever kind of service, and they never get paid. And in order to get paid, they have to hire an attorney to go out and file a suit and get a judgment, try to execute. And I'd be interested in hearing from some, association of private utilities if they ever considered this for themselves, because I can see where under certain circumstances it's why a utility, municipal or otherwise, would be frustrated by the situation.
Okay. Are there any further questions for Mr. Stancliffe? Thank you, Mr. Stancliffe, and we have Susan Knowles here to testify also through teleconference. Susan, welcome. You have the mic.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, he can.
Okay. I have previously sent by fax, and I hope you have available to you the comments the Commission prepared on the companion bill that is, was earlier referenced, that is pending before the Senate, Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 207. So I won't, assuming that you have them, I will not read those to you, but will highlight a couple of points that we would at least like to make you aware of. As you probably know, we do concern ourselves with the question of what happens when consumers are not prompt in paying for services they receive from utilities. And we have promulgated certain rules, at least insofar as cell phone and electric utilities are concerned, which do provide for certain notice to consumers when they are behind in their payments and do allow for services to be disconnected when noticing requirements are met and when payments are not forthcoming. We also have in our regulations provisions for consumers to enter into payment agreements, if you will, with utilities if they should be in a particularly bad period in terms of personal finances, so that they can make good their obligations but have a little bit of leeway in making those payments. The thought that occurred to us is that this bill does allow for a different, I guess, type of relief than the type of relief we are used to, which is the placement of a lien on property. And two, it does not appear to have built within it some of the notice and, I guess, opportunities for payment of delinquencies that we normally believe are desirable to affect a proper balance between the consumer's obligation to pay and yet the utility's control over what are typically very vital services. So we would bring to your attention that the relief allowed here does seem to be quite strong and somewhat different from that which we have normally worked out in our particular arena. The other couple of, I guess, relative to the concerns expressed by the city of Nenana, it's been our experience that you can have situations where tenants are responsible for payment of utility bills, and tenants may default or take a walk or whatever, and the landlords may be totally unaware of the extent of the problem until they sort through the what's left behind. And at that point, they may already find themselves faced with a lien on property, which, again, given sort of the lack of notice and the lack of awareness that a problem exists, may be a rather harsh recourse. We do allow and encourage, of course, situations where the landlord makes itself known to the utility as being the party that's ultimately responsible, and in that case, this particular problem might not occur, but it is a little bit of a concern from our perspective also. The other thing that we recognize, and I think this is supportive of the concern that's expressed by Nenana, is that it's a lot more difficult to disconnect water and sewer services than it is electric and telephone services. And so you could have a person in a situation where they were not paying, and yet you don't want to necessarily go in and dig up the ground in the middle of the winter in order to terminate service to them. So your recourse is a little bit more tenuous in the water and sewer area. And I guess for these reasons, we would suggest that as you look at the legislation and try to balance the concerns municipalities may have for getting paid, that you may wish to limit this bill to those utility services where some of the typical disconnection recourses are not necessarily as readily available. And with that, I will conclude my remarks and stand ready for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Knowles, are there any questions for Susan Knowles? Hearing none, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome, and good luck with your deliberations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Okay, goodbye. I'd like to put this House Bill 266 for a subcommittee group to review, and Sherry and Representative Foster, would you mind being on the subcommittee?
No, I'm already on one.
One? What is one? Susan, would you care to be also a resource person on this subcommittee?
She might not have heard you, ma'am. I was talking to her. You might repeat the question.
Susan Knowles, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Would you be interested in working with the subcommittee on this House Bill 266?
I would be pleased to be a resource to the committee.
Okay, thank you very much, because we are going to put it before subcommittee.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, and Representative Foster, you'll chair the subcommittee.
Okay, if somebody would just contact me whenever they need me, I'd be happy to help.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The next bill that we have on is House Bill 253.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You'll also work with the subcommittee. We're waiting to get on the teleconference here. Did I wake you up, Mr. Foster?
Oh, no.
I was just shocked at the responsibility.